Hello. So mine is pretty different than everyone else's. So I guess I'll start here with I have nothing to disclose before I begin speaking. Well, as you see, everyone knows the overview of PCMH. From a Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan perspective, we're looking at it to encourage patient and physician relationships. From the patient side, we hope and expect for them to take more of an active role in their own healthcare and navigating this healthcare system, but with coordinating with their primary care physician, knowing their health status and practice and ongoing health management. So we at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan have one of the nation's largest PCMH programs, and we currently have a little more than 5,000 primary care physicians participating. So to give you an idea of where we're coming from, we are a nonprofit organization, and in Michigan, we're the payer of last resort. And we currently work with over 20,000 specialty and primary care physicians in the state of Michigan, covering about 45% market share, so it's 4.7 million Michigan residents. And we have all types of products, like the commercial, we have some Medicare, and we've started working with the Medicaid population. But everything I talk to you about now is dealing with your commercially insured members, specifically the PPO, where they don't have an assigned PCP, and they are free to kind of roam around the system as they desire. And just for those of you who do not know, the Blue Cross of Michigan is independent from all the other Blue Cross Blue Shields, but we're all covered under the association. So before I start talking about our PCMH program specifically, it's kind of under the umbrella of what we call our Physician Group Incentive Program, or lovingly PGIP, which started in 2004. So this is our big, broad incentive program with our goal of lowering healthcare costs and reducing patient complications. And we do this by providing incentives for infrastructure development, helping them to build capabilities, helping them to work with more care management for their patients. And all physicians in Michigan are eligible to participate, but how they participate is they join as a group, or what we consider a physician organization. So as a large group of physicians, they then can select what programs they want to participate and how they want to start navigating through PCMH. So currently we have almost 15,000 primary and specialty care physicians participating in this big umbrella program. And we provide financial incentives that they can then direct how to spend them. So they can use that money to reimburse their physicians, or they can use this money to invest in those information systems, electronic medical records, and so on. And this year we have nearly $100 million for them to almost compete for. So to do this, they work through, as those organizations, multiple initiatives. So here is a brief example of some of the types of programs that they can elect to participate. And when I say they elect, we have different, we give them data back, feedback, reports, all the resources that they need, but we don't tell them exactly what to do. That's up to the physicians, and they can work and see what they want to do to improve. So taking this big umbrella incentive program, I'm sorry, I'm kind of losing my voice, I've been sick this week. What they do for PCMH is we're focusing on these 12 initiatives within the core clinical process and the clinical IT. Now going a little bit further into PCMH, all those physicians that are currently in our PGIP program are eligible to participate. We've been doing this for 3 years, and what we do at Blue Cross is we do a PCMH designation. So we started this in 2008. And what we do are within these physician organizations, they're smaller practices of mixed, some are specialty care, some are primary care, and some are mixed together. And so we work with these organizations and we ask them to nominate what practices do they think are really moving towards PCMH, are making these advancements, and they feel are ready to go to this next step. And then among those that they nominate, we then look at these capabilities, but all those things that I listed before within those 12 initiatives. Do you have extended access? Do you have a registry in place? Things that you're working towards to build this system. And then we measure them based on performance, cost, and use metrics. What's a combination of this? And from here we designate our higher performing practices. And those designated receive an uplift in their E&M codes. So currently they get a 10% boost. So it's a way for us to bring up primary care. So our objective for just this study was just to look at what's the impact of providing these capabilities in our PCMH program and looking at the outcome of potentially avoidable emergency and department visits, or how we're defining them as primary care sensitive, among those who are participating versus those that aren't participating. And just a recap of all those initiatives or capabilities that they have to work on. I'm looking just now at providing extended access. So just real quick, what we call members, we are including all those members who are enrolled in one of our commercial products during 2009. We're just looking at those 0 to 64, so we excluded the Medicare population because of a claims issue. If they turn 65 at a certain time, we want to make sure we are able to capture all of their claims and our outcomes. We ask that they're Michigan residents during this time and that they receive the majority of their care with one of these PCPs. So how we do that, because it is a PPO and not an HMO, they're not assigned to a physician, we use an algorithm through the claims to determine exactly who do we think is their PCP that they're attributed to. And I kind of go through the arrows, and you can read it yourself to see. We look at how many office visits for evaluation and management services do they have and who they saw. And if there's a tie there, we go through until we end up filtering it down to one PCP who's responsible for their care. And with this, we excluded those who happened to go to the emergency department, but at least, 10 times or more. So we excluded those outliers. From the practice perspective, we only included those participating in the PGIP program as of December 2009. And each of the practices, while they can have a variety of specialties, they had to contain at least one PCP. And we had to exclude, based on sample size issues, certain criteria. So we got rid of the practices. We did include them in our analysis who had less than 50 attributed members or less than 10 members who had an emergency department visit during that time period or less than 100 less than 100 members and who are outliers with that net PCS rate. So with our data, we use two different types. So we have our internal Blue Cross administrative claims data, which we use to measure outcomes of our ED visit rates. And then we also had the self-reported data from these physician organizations, which describe the capabilities in place and at what level they're implemented for each of their practices. So they are responsible as an organization level to go and just talk with their practices and understand what capabilities and where they are in this progress. So we combine these two. And for the outcome, we used to measure these primary care sensitive emergency department rates and reported them as per 1,000 members per year. And for the denominator, we didn't just use counting a member as one person because, well, with insurance, you can come and go as you please. You have different months of coverage. So we, for each of those members, we would sum up the months of coverage during this time period to not bias one or the other. And just briefly, primary care sensitive, we defined by applying the New York University ED classification algorithm to our internal claims data. So it's quickly, this is how they broke up their definitions, and we included those services that were non-emergent, primary care treatable, or preventable avoidable as how they defined primary care sensitive. And the exposures that we're looking at, specifically extended access, we have four different categories. Did those practices offer 24-hour telephone access for their members? Did they have a systematic approach to inform patients of their after-hours care, including the location and the times available? And do their patients at these practices have access to non-ED-related after-hours providers on the weekends? And we measured it in two different ways, 8 to 11 hours on their weekends, or did those practices have it for 12 or more hours? And among those who had advanced scheduling, so reserving at least 30% of their same-day appointments for routine or urgent care, again, broken up, we looked at between 30 and 49% of those appointments available, or 50% or more. And some of the confounders we used to adjust for, we looked at a few member characteristics. So we have gender, the percent of members who are male. We did a mean prospective risk score. And because we don't have a lot of demographic information in our claims data, we use something from the Symmetry engine. So a risk score takes last year's claims and accounting for their age and sex of the member and applies it to predict how much that member would cost next year, giving it a scale of 0 to... I think it's pretty much like infinity, but basically they're around between 1 to 2. We also looked at the patient mix of the practices, primarily those who are pediatric, and then we looked at the size of the practices, so the number of physicians in each one, categorized them into solo practice, 2 to 3 physicians, or 4 or more, and then the rurality of the practice location. And here is just describing the levels of rurality that we included. So you have your suburban, rural, and then among the urban, we broke it up between highly populated, medium populated, and low populated. So for the statistical analysis, and I know I'm running through this really fast, we use linear regression models and generalized estimating equations to control for the clustering of practices within each of the bigger physician organizations. And we use SAS version 9.2 in the PROC Gen mod. So this is what we found. Kind of boring at the beginning, but we included 1.5 million members in our total Attrivia population, and among those, 47% were male. The average risk score was 1.46. So like I said, what we find typically is 0 to 2. So that's pretty much what we find in a lot of our other analysis too. And the mean age was about 37 years. For the practices, we found that the majority, 73%, were family, so they had the mix of pediatric and adults, with 13% being adult only, and about the same for kids. And we found this for the past few years, and it's very interesting, that over half, about 57% of the number of physicians in a practice are solo practitioners. So, next steps, we kind of wonder, how is this going to work to be more integrated and help when you're a single doc? And then, again, over half are among those highly populated urban areas. So among those practices, so we have a little over 2,000 participating practices. How many have these extended access capabilities? Well, the 24-hour telephone access is the most prevalent with 57%. About a third have that systematic approach to informing their patients of other solutions for after-hours care. Oddly enough, for the access to non-ED during the weekend, more of them had 12 or more hours open versus those who had 8 to 11 hours. And about 14% schedule 30 to 49% of their appointments available for same day. Now looking at the impact of these extended access capabilities on those potentially avoidable ED visit rates, we evaluate each of these capabilities independently. So we have our results for overall for our 0 to 64 population, and then we look down how would it model separately for kids and then adults. So generally for overall, those that were statistically significant were the telephone access, having that systematic approach, and having 8 to 11 hours of their non-ED after-hours care provided. And then for the pediatric population, the only thing that was significant was having 30 to 49% of your same-day appointments. And for adults, it was just the 24-hour phone access and the systematic approach. And just a summary of just what I repeated. For everyone, you had the 3. And we found that the practices offering advanced scheduling, they didn't have any and they weren't significant, which we thought was a little interesting for the total population. And for kids, it was more significant for them, which we were thinking if you have a sick kid, they happen to be available, you can run to your PCP, and it's a little easier to get into. You might be more likely to do that for your child versus yourself. And then what we found is, digging into this, is that this small research project, it does show like the importance of providing extended access to PCP practices, because all of ours in our program are working to reduce these potentially avoidable emergency department visits, and it helps them to know where really to steer. But with the different results, we were wondering how this is going to affect the practices financially. So those who reserve maybe too many appointments available up, to 50%, if it hurts their bottom line versus availability. So there is the time. I'm sorry. So that's one of the issues that we're looking into. Just some of the strengths. We have a very large sample size with over 2,000 practices and 1.5 million members. And then we like the fact they're including both the self-report and the administrative data. And this isn't the first round of either one. This is about for the self-report, it's our third iteration, so the practices are a little more comfortable with the questions and they can answer them and they understand what these capabilities really mean to evaluate if they do have them in place. And we've been evaluating these types of emergency department visits for about 3 years, so we've kind of worked out the kinks within the claim system. Limitations, some of that EV classification algorithm, there are some issues with it because there's a small sample size that they used to develop it. And then from our administrative claims perspective, we didn't include rejected claims, meaning if the patient went to the doctor but somehow it wasn't covered or they didn't have our coverage at the time, it wasn't included in our analysis. There was no way we could put it in. So we might have been missing a few, but we think it's less than 1%. So running through that.
I have a question. I'm also from Michigan, and I'm just being introduced to the concept of medical home. I've actually spent 14 years in local public health, and we were going through a community health improvement exercise, and we're looking at the community or the child healthcare access programs, which are becoming pretty huge in Michigan. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those, and if Blue Cross Blue Shield will be getting more involved with those. I know that those are more geared towards Medicaid populations and kind of like bridging these patient-centered care facilities together and bringing the community aspect into that.
I think so. Because I know that's another department that it's pretty new, is like the Medicaid, and they're all looking, how do you tie this in, not only for commercial, but for like the Medicare population, bringing our program to all the other ones that are participating.
So curious, I think one of the things you noticed was that the hours, like providing like the extra hours of access was really important. Is there any way that you all will be supporting maybe like urgent care? Is there a push to that, considering that maybe the primary care system is not able to always capture folks, and that's why they're ending up in the emergency room or things like that? Like, does that have any potential impact on your system?
Oh, I think so. I'm not sure what you mean by support. I mean, we cover urgent care visits. So I think part of these offering other alternatives are promoting urgent care, having the PCP tell their patients, look, these are the urgent care places you can go to when I'm not open.
And that's happening now, that
bridge.
Yes.
Would you consider looking at the ED visits that are preventable outside of this analysis? Those seem less able to be impacted by the access and scheduling issues that you're looking at than the ones that are actually be treatable or non-emergent.
Oh, you mean splitting out those three? Mm-hmm. We could.
We haven't done that yet.
And for other programs that we have that giant list, I know specifically for chronic kidney disease, we're looking into feeding data back from providers into us so we can tie it together, because you're right, we don't have those clinical outcomes. And I guess from a university perspective, right now we're partnering with the University of Michigan. We have an AHRQ grant to evaluate our PCMH program at a broader scale.
Yes, I'm curious, what does it mean for a solo practitioner to be available on the weekend?
That's something we want to figure out, too.
Yeah, I was talking about having someone, you know, a physician on call. Is it that simple?
I think part of it is like having one on call, or if so, they can have that phone access themselves. That makes sense. But being physically available, I think it's just having something in place where it might not be that one physician, but they have a system in place that they can go to. And that's some of the things we're working with getting the feedback from the physicians. We meet with them quarterly in person. We talked about best practices so we can understand what exactly are you doing so we can help you engage with that.
Two more questions. I'm wondering to what extent you shared this information with providers, and if you have links, if you meet them, an ongoing system of sharing data, whether you know it's just claims usage, hospital admissions, or ED visits with the providers, because they may have no idea that they have a patient that's been to the ED five times or was admitted to the hospital if they're not sharing that information.
We provide raw claims feeds for all their members monthly, and we've created quarterly reports and actual pretty access data sets, drop-down menus to kind of get them, because we want them to be more engaged with data to understand it. So we've been feeding this to them for about 5 years now.
That's great.
Is there one more question? I would like to thank you then, Ms. Carrier. And before I thank the whole panel, it's very encouraging that we have this move now toward patient-centered medical homes, but I want to throw something out for our horizon for the next 10 years or 20 years, and it's something actually very old. As we talk about patient-centered medical homes, actually at Prevention Institute now you've heard about community-centered health homes, which is actually harkening back to a very old model of community-oriented primary care, so that we don't just try to assure excellent care for those who can access the system, for those who come into our doors, but that actually eventually health systems or practices will take responsibility for a geographically defined community to take care not only of unmet need or incompletely met need, but also of maybe unrecognized need, and to define the need for communities and perhaps even step outside of the medical model and address social determinants of health. So it's quite encouraging, all of the work that's going on, establishing patient-centered medical homes, evaluating the impacts of these. But as we get success there, I think we should push even further toward what now is being called community-centered health homes, or the old terminology is with community-oriented primary care. I hope that all of us will be interested in continuing in this journey. Thank you. Thank the panel. Thank you for your time.